Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of the network, and each week we search the internet for terrific new books, and we ask the authors to come on the show and talk to us about the books. And this week, I'm very pleased to say we have Liz Pleck on the show, and we'll be talking about her book, Not Just Roommates, Cohabitation After the Sexual Revolution. Thanks for coming on the show, Elizabeth.
You're welcome.
Or let me do that again. Thanks for coming on the show, Liz.
You're welcome.
There we go. Perhaps you could begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself.
I am a professor emerita of history at the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana. And my work has been in U.S. women's and family history. And I've written various aspects of that topic in my whole career, and worked around the prior to marriage, the ritualization of marriage, the rejection of marriage, the shadow of marriage, and also how that fits with different racial and ethnic groups.
Mm-hmm. So this particular book is about what we might call non-marriage, that is cohabitation. And tell us why you wrote it.
Well, I saw this cohabitation as the missing piece of the aftermath of the sexual revolution of the 1960s. That is, there's usually a sentence that says that as a result of the 60s, there were these huge changes such as more single parenthood, more divorce, of course, cohabitation. And cohabitation is just this add-on or supplement. It's mentioned, but it's seen as something that's so obvious that it wouldn't deserve a history. And what I think is interesting is that it still is in the margins, but it's one of the most significant changes in sexual life and marriage in the family since the 1960s. Something not just happening in the U.S., but happening in all developed countries, and part of, I guess, what we would call a trend towards much more flexible relationships or shorter duration marriage-like relationships that are becoming a huge and significant development in many countries.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't we begin by talking about the history and the demographics themselves. Talk to us a little bit about the change in the rate of cohabitation from roughly the post-war, that is post-Second World War period, to today, and attendant demographic developments like the increase in the number of divorces and things like that.
Well, since we have a historian's audience, I would begin by saying if we go way back in time, we would say that it would really be hard to distinguish cohabiting from marriage because marriage was more a process than a formal ceremony, and because people simply pretended to be married even when they weren't, so there was a great deal of that. But when we're talking here, what we're talking about in our conversation is 1960s in developed world and on. And there, what we have, 1960 to present, is a 35-fold increase in the rate of cohabiting in that space of time. And that's probably the most major unilinear trend in family and sexual life that one can find. In the 60s, we're talking about a profile of a relatively small group of people. Let's say if you could measure it accurately, which you can't, we would put it in the, say, 200,000 to 400,000 person range. And we would be describing people who are poor, not well educated, interracial, bohemian, college students. And now, if we talk about cohabitation in the U.S., We're talking about a group that's 16.5 million strong. It's still overweighted towards the lower end of the social scale, so more minorities, more poorly educated, but it is actually the first union formation, the term that demographers might use, for the standard pathway that people enter their first unions, and either then they go from there to marriage or then they go from there to breaking up. Mm-hmm. And the other development that is absolutely huge, 40% of all households today of cohabitors are child-rearing units, or if when we're talking about the 60s, people have in mind a lot of couples who don't have kids at all. Now, 40% households of cohabitors have children, and there are one or more biological children of both parents, and half are from the cohabiting union itself.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I see. So would it be correct to say that prior to, say, 1970-ish, that the norm was not to cohabitate before marriage, and after 85 or 90, it became the norm to cohabitate before marriage?
I would say if we just add in there a middle class, for middle class, the ideal and the standard was you did not do this. And 80s, and if you did, you lied about it.
Mm-hmm.
And from the 80s and 90s, you did it. And you didn't lie to about it, or you didn't have to, and parents didn't expect you to lie. And I'd say the parentheses around there is there are some groups where it's still necessary to lie and conceal. But on the whole, we're talking about the standard for the society. That's a huge shift.
Mm-hmm, I see. So now the most difficult question, I suppose, and that is why the rise of cohabitation? I suppose we could talk about that for about a week, but let's try to boil it down.
Well, actually, I find that the easiest question. It's in the sense of the causes are not so hard. It's the way it ripples out into society and the way that society responds to it that seems to me to be the most puzzling. But the answer that I would give is many factors: feminism, effective birth control, rising age of marriage, prevalence of divorce. Divorce makes people marriage shy. Decline of religious morality that says that you don't have to wait until marriage to have sexual intercourse. And then I think the one that's more recent, which is the standard expectation for what it is that you have to have in place before you marry has been greatly rising. And that brings in my previous work, which is not only is it what you have to have in place in terms of a bank account or a job, but also the standard of what you want in terms of a wedding ritual has risen so greatly that people delay. So all of these are pushing the sociologists who say marriage is it's the gold standard or it's the ideal, but it is also a kind of privileged status, and people that all of those things that people are also a little afraid of it, and so it's pushed off into the distance, and these other forms of relating are developing as placeholders, but they're becoming more prominent.
Yeah. So would it be correct to say, you know, I'm thinking about a cocktail party conversation or a elevator conversation, that I guess what we'd call the decline of marriage and the rise of cohabitation is a result of people being scared of making a commitment?
That's one part of it. Certainly one part of it. And part of what they're scared of is they have divorced or they are children of divorce. And they know that there is something to be feared about the marriage state. So that with cohabitation, for example, is the absolute first pathway for people who are remarrying. They definitely want to try this thing out before they're willing to sign on the dotted line. Mm-hmm. So it's certainly part of it.
Mm-hmm. I just find that very interesting in the sense that it's not an affirmative thing. That is, people don't say, I'm going to cohabitate because it's the right thing to do. They say, I'm going to cohabitate because I'm scared of the alternative.
Well, as in all of these studies of demography, those, there's some who are in the latter category. So some people, this is the smallest group of cohabitors, are people who have a positive view that they are looking for an institution other than legal marriage and are approaching cohabitation as a more flexible form and they're a critique of marriage. But on the whole, most cohabitors are not ideologically opposed to marriage. They're not ready for it, or they're not, or they're afraid of it. But they could envision themselves entering into it at some future time.
Mm-hmm.
So, in that sense, cohabitation really mostly exists in the shadow of marriage, rather than as a true alternative to it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I see. So, talk to us just a little bit about the ways in which people who are cohabiting are discriminated against. And again, I'm a little bit mindful of the terminology here because I guess I'm not sure that the promotion of marriage is the same as discrimination against cohabitors. In the book, you say that it is. I'm not quite clear on that, but you can talk about it a little bit. Go ahead.
Well, here's an example of it. In 1960, well, this is okay. One definition of being second class citizen or is being denied the right to vote. So, in 1960, Louisiana passed a constitutional amendment that disenfranchised anyone who had lived in a common law marriage within 5 years of applying to vote. Now, the reason they did this is not because they were so terribly concerned about cohabitors, but because they saw it as a proxy for race,
mm-hmm.
that it would be more common among blacks. And this was a backdoor Jim Crow attempt to disenfranchise blacks, and which is often the case that cohabitation is a form, can be used as a form of race control or Jim Crow race control. But in this case, it is a clear instance of denial of citizenship rights based on cohabitation. And just to consider the contrast, in the history of the gay rights movement, there is no case like a constitutional amendment like that,
uh-huh.
where gay people have been denied the right to vote,
mm-hmm.
Because of their sexual orientation or living status.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one example. There aren't other states that do it. But it is most common in these days in terms of employment, housing, military policies. So in housing, there are zoning rules that are still in existence, although rarely enforced, that prohibit cohabitors from living in certain towns, in certain areas of a town. There are no protections for employment discrimination against people who cohabit. There are three states, in all these three states, the law is no longer enforced. Or it's still on the books that cohabitation is a crime. Last person to be arrested for the crime of cohabitation, I think, was probably 2003. There are people today who are arrested for adultery. You can punch up this information on the web. You'll find a 2013 arrest in Florida for adultery. Cohabitors cannot sponsor their partners for immigration purposes. Cohabitors in the military, prohibited from living on base housing, many other benefits. Cohabitors in the U.S. are the most likely group by marital status. Straight cohabitors to lack health insurance. 30% of straight cohabitors do not have have health in church.
Mm-hmm. So let's turn the question around. Why does the United States promote marriage, and why has it?
Well, in answering the question, I think you have to say this is not a recent phenomena in the U.S. It's actually a very strong tradition in the United States. In fact, I would say that it's one of the traditions that makes the United States what it is, which is it's a highly religious country where it has a formal separation of church and state, but informally it uses religious morality as a principle for providing social benefits and for dividing and controlling the population, and that has remained the case up to the present day. And in fact, whereas you could say that this was also a tradition in many other countries, you find that many of these developed countries gradually chip away at their tradition. Whereas in the United States, the nature of the sexual revolution and what we call the culture war was that it reinvigorated and reinforced that tradition of marriage and privileging marriage in U.S. society. And I said it had a religious component, but the religious mixes in with the idea that of the nation, which is that the country faces these various crises, and marriage is kind of a symbol of the stability of the nation, and therefore strong marriage needs to be defended in order to make for a strong nation. And that kind of rhetoric appears time and again. It appeared most recently in Samuel Alito's questioning about same-sex marriage in these cases in the last month. And but the belief that legal marriage is the foundation of the nation is a very strong statement, powerful statement, and animating force in our legislation and policy.
Mm-hmm. I guess just speaking from my own experience, and this includes gay friends of mine that are supporters of gay marriage, the primary argument they give for marriage is that it's the way we raise children, and married couples are better at raising children than cohabitors. And so if you're going to have children, you should get married. I mean, that has nothing to do with God whatsoever, and certainly doesn't have anything to do with the nation. I mean, I know that in my own, I'm just speaking for myself. When I think about why people should get married, it's because they may have children, and they need to make a commitment to those children, and they shouldn't get divorced, and they should raise those children.
Well, let's see. The first thing to say about cohabiting is that the studies are not very positive about cohabiting in children. They might change because cohabiting is becoming more lengthy, but it's not a particularly beneficial relationship in which to raise children. And that doesn't weaken the arguments about state involvement. It actually strengthens them, which is that we have a way of living among 16.5 million people that is growing stronger with millions of children in it, in which the basic social provisions are denied these children. And because of the way that we draw a dividing line around marriage, and the dividing line around marriage, which is not being challenged by same-sex, at least the way it's construed now. Well, same-sex marriage, the arguments now are to make a stronger dividing line between legal marriage and non-marriage. Mm-hmm. And what that effectively does is that the people who are below the line, that is outside of the marriage institution, they're less likely to get the absolute key benefits that we provide through marriage rather than citizenship. the way I would put it, state this is the marriage rather than citizenship provides for Social Security, which is the retirement benefit and disability and survivor's benefit. And also marriage is the filter through, rather than citizenship, through which people get health insurance. And given that, to make such a strong division between legal marriage and those outside of legal marriage essentially creates a have and have not relationship divide. And in these other countries that would be the examples of all the Scandinavian countries and France and Holland, et cetera, they make fewer distinctions between the married and non-married in terms of those things and benefits and tax status, et cetera. And they instead, they define it as couples who are together for a certain period of time or when they're as a child. And so that if we were really committed to children, we would look at the minimum standard of living necessary for children, irregardless of the formal legal status of the situation in which they are raised. Instead, we're emphasizing a kind of moral ideal and trying to incentivize people to get into it at the same time that we're going to leave out all of the other people who are choosing or waiting, depending on your view, to get into marriage, choosing to stay out of marriage or waiting to get into it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one thing that immediately occurs to me, though, is it seems like marriage is all upside and no downside. So it would seem to me somebody who's a critic of cohabitation would say, well, just get married. What's the penalty? There's no penalty. It's all upside.
That is what makes the cohabitation argument less appealing to people rather than as opposed to the same-sex marriage argument. Mm-hmm. Cohabitation is a less appealing argument precisely because these are people who are have the legal and constitutional option of the right to marry and choose not to do so. And the one exception is people who are separated and still married, yeah, and but are in a cohabiting relationship. But in our view, this is the what would be the equivalent of the undeserving poor. These are people who had the choice and are not choosing to do it. And I would say, in our way of thinking, there is no such thing as the right not to marry or the right not to have to marry. And that is because, in fact, we don't think that there is anything wrong with the idea that we should incentivize marriage even to the point of coercing it. And so in that view, this is an undeserving category. But if you turn it the other way, you look at the other way of the glass, and you say that a right to privacy means, in an expanded right to privacy, you don't coerce into something that people are not ready to choose, and that such things as health insurance are a basic right of all individuals, irrespective of their marital status, then in that sense, then you all of a sudden start to look at this entirely differently. Yeah. Why, for example, do we have Social Security benefits for the survivor's benefits for the divorced when they're not in the marital state? They've left it and, in fact, rejected it. Whereas there are no Social Security survivor's benefits for people who are cohabiting.
Well, I mean, I guess I think the answer to that question, again, I'm thinking of a particular friend of mine who's quite conservative, what he would say is that the people that made that commitment deserve a benefit. The people who did not stand before us and make that commitment don't.
Well, that was their choice. That is the way our society works, that we, and that is why I think the United States is exceptional and unique in that sense that your conservative friend is echoing the fact that the United States has a much more conservative approach to family and marriage in its social policy. And what the historian is interested in is, that's very interesting about the United States. We know all other ways it's exceptional. This one is not discussed very much. And one needs to contrast it with other countries and understand why it's so, and look at the historical developments that have underlie it. And the puzzling feature about it is that this phenomena of and marriage is tremendously incentivized in terms and promoted in terms of state policy and ideas, is that it exists at the same time that sexual revolution has been taking place in the United States as in many other developed countries, and that the acceptance of cohabitation has increased dramatically, with the idea that there's very little personal stigma attached to cohabitation anymore. Mm-hmm. So that the phenomenon itself has not been stopped or impeded in any way, but it's the law and policy that are tremendously out of sync with the actual development. And that is what is different about the United States. United States, Canada, Holland, or France, or Scandinavia.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I was interested to learn in your book, and also this occurred to me while I was reading it, though, is that in the United States, I think marriage is a very healthy institution. You're right, it is somewhat in decline. But in comparison to other places I've lived, and particularly in Western Europe and also in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, where marriage is much more of a kind of a, I don't know what to call it. It doesn't happen as often, and children are often born out of wedlock there, and no one seems to be bothered by it. And again, this is an argument that a conservative might make, is that those places have a real problem because their birth rates are declining. In the United States, this is not true anymore. People are encouraged to get married by the state, and they're also encouraged to have children. Now, this isn't to say that, of course, they aren't encouraged to have children in France. They are. I have a friend that lives in France. They'll pay you to have children. They still don't have children. So, it seems to me that the people that argue that marriage and the promotion of childbearing within marriage is good for the Republic have, in the comparative frame, have a point. Or am I wrong about that? I mean, again, that's what my... I won't say who this guy. I won't say who this guy.
Marriage encourages childbearing, and childbearing is necessary for population growth, and population growth is necessary for economic development.
No, not even economic development. I mean,
so
these places.
I would say that actually, it's that. I would say that it's immigration and cohabitation encourage a higher birth rate, and higher birth rate is a phenomenon in the U.S., and I agree that it encourages economic growth and is actually good for welfare state, because it means that more people are available to contribute to social systems that essentially pass on tax revenues.
Let me just explain how
you get that. First of all, a birth rate, although declining among Hispanics, is a major contributor to American growth in birth rate, and Hispanic immigration is highly associated with cohabitation. In fact, Hispanics have a long tradition of informal marriage and a rural pattern of cohabitation, which is continuing when they immigrate to the U.S. And the second I would say is that actually you look at American birth rates and you can see that these births are occurring within the cohabiting relationship, not within marriage. And that is the kind of fundamental transformation at the bottom of society, which is that people are living together, they're having a child together, and then they're waiting and deciding whether or not that will be convert into a legal marriage, and making the distinction between childbearing and marriage as two separate things. And the American birth rate is actually coming from not from the tradition of marriage, but from this immigration and the new patterns of cohabiting and childbearing and within cohabitation.
So the rate.
And if we really want to encourage a higher birth rate, it's probably the case that it's cohabitation, lengthening out the period of cohabitation and actually providing more supports to people in cohabitation, which would probably be fit with that kind of pattern.
So let me just understand this. You're saying then that the rate of reproduction among cohabiting couples is greater, that is of childbearing age, is greater than the rate of reproduction among married couples of childbearing age.
I don't know the rate of reproduction figures. I just know that the pattern at the lower end of the social scale, now the norm is that people are in cohabiting relationships and have children in cohabiting relationships. And then some of those convert to legal marriage and others do not. But it's an absolutely huge trend.
Mm-hmm.
And that 40% of all births to children are in such cohabiting relationships.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I guess one of the things you're saying then is that if we acknowledge this fact and we no longer, A, stigmatized childbearing out of wedlock in cohabiting relationships, and B, more importantly, we supported these people, that is, with public aid of various sorts, then the disadvantage which children face in cohabiting couples would sort of disappear. They would be treated just like the children of married couples.
Well, I think the disadvantage probably wouldn't disappear. But and if you want my value statement, is that we need to put a floor under children,
yeah,
and not put the floor under marriage.
Yeah.
And if you put a floor under children, it is that we have a kind of minimum level standard of living that all children have, irrespective of the residential arrangements in which they are found, and that's quite different from. As your very apt statement of our current policy, which is to promote marriage. Our policy is we put the floor under marriage, and then we try to get as many people into that as possible. And my argument is that doesn't work, and it's not realistic, and it's not happening. And we've tried, our entire history is trying to have that. The nature of a kind of American liberal ideology, at least since kind of Kinsey, is that one has to look at people's actual ways that they live in their sexual lives and their family lives, and that law and policy should come closer to being able to recognize that that's how they live. And that the point is not to impose a single moral standard on that.
Mm-hmm.
And that once you do that, that will then lead you to an entirely different view of what our policy is.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk then specifically about the ways in which, let's just imagine a notional couple, you know, they're 23 years old, they've been cohabiting for a few years, and they have one kid. How are they different than another notional couple that's married, 23, they've been cohabiting since they got married, and they have one kid?
Our couple that are married and have one child I can answer that. The way you've stacked up comparison is that the age of marriage is held constant, that we have both 23-year-olds.
Well, we can make it different if you want to make a difference.
Well, the reason I wanted to tell you about the reason this is different is because essentially right now we have marriage has a very strong class divide, and it's getting stronger. And class means class, social class, and education, specifically bachelor's degree or more.
Mm-hmm.
So that the people college educated are now, as this is as distinct from 60s and 70s, college educated now are less likely to get divorced than in the general population. They are somewhat less likely to cohabit prior to the union. They are much more likely to have children within a legal marriage and to wait until they're legally married until and subsequently to have children. So all of that kind of what we call the traditional package is associated with the two-earner college-educated couple. And then the other contrast is then you look at the people who have some college or not, or but not full 4 years, or high school, et cetera. And there you find much more of cohabitation, serial cohabitation, childbearing within the cohabiting relationship, and then it does or does not evolve into legal marriage. And the cohabiting begins at an earlier age. Mm-hmm. So all of this is just saying we have a new kind of class picture of marriage on one side, cohabiting relationships on the other, which is much more associated with a kind of post sexual revolution, post-industrial kind of economy, where the benefits are clearly going to the people who are college educated, and they are forming new kind of more stable kind of marriages, the two-earner kind of marriage. But that's not what's happening at the bottom of the society, or the bottom to the middle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. What I really meant by the question was, I mean, in terms of their legal status, that is married and unmarried, and vis-a-vis sort of state benefits, that would be things like the opportunity to get welfare, visitation rights in hospitals, tax credits, things like this. What differentiates the married from the unmarried couple? Because your thesis, as I understand it, is that the unmarried couple is at a disadvantage in terms of state benefits.
The most clearest one is if these people, if one of these two people dies in the relationship and they have been employed with Social Security, mm-hmm. then the woman in the relationship gets no Social Security survivor's benefit. And that's because she was not legally married. So the kid will receive something, but the woman will not. And she is most likely to be the caretaker for the child. Mm-hmm. Moreover, yes, hospitals would have, hospitals vary in their rules, but she would not have had a legal right to visit the partner in the hospital. As I said, the most important is that these are people who are much more likely, unless they have an enlightened employer with domestic partnership benefits, they're much more likely to be not have dependent health insurance for the dependent partner.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, and again, this is asking you to speculate a little bit, but it's very interesting. I mean, this is what you say is very convincing, and it is certainly consistent with my own experience. The people I know who are in stable long-term relationships with kids are college educated. And the people that I know who are not. And I happen by another connection to know a lot of young women who are single mothers. It has to do with some volunteer work I do. And they are uniformly not college graduates. That's quite true. And they also are uniformly without the support of the fathers of the children. And they did cohabitate. So what you say is very convincing. So what should we do then? I guess, I don't know. I just don't. How would you encourage people to stay with their partners and raise their children outside promoting marriage?
Well, I actually let people work on their Well, first of all, yes, there are many people who want to work on anger management, relationship skills, yeah. and all of these things. And if they do, my idea is that our health insurance programs should promote, should all of our health insurance programs should make it available for mental health yeah. as well as physical health.
Yeah.
But that is a way of saying, I don't like our welfare programs today now have as a component of them that they have various relationship skills counseling that are basically through they're called marriage promotion programs, and they're basically through our welfare departments, and in which we're using that as the carrot to get people to incentivize people to marry. I would say what we want to incentivize is we want to incentivize people to retrain and get education for themselves. And if they choose to figure out how to, if they choose to get more counseling about relationships, that's fine. Most of the studies indicate that women are more interested in such relationship counseling than men, and that it's much more likely that people who are more middle class are interested in such counseling than others. And that's why I tend towards the basics. In our society, we have a tremendous emphasis on the value that increased training and education gives you in terms of the labor market. It's not working for everybody, even our college educated today, but it's definitely at the bottom. The opposite is definitely the case, that less education is a real detriment in terms of one's success. So I would say instead of putting posters on buses encouraging people to get relationship counseling, we should restore those credits so that people can go back to community college yeah. for training
yeah.
and that there should be child care credits that go with that so that people have access to that while they're going back for training.
Yeah.
So it's a question of I realize we're cutting back on things, but as I said, my study shows you where have our priorities gone to or been, and there is a tremendous privileging of marriage mm-hmm. in the society and its programs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, what you say is consistent with my own experience. Again, my mother got married very young to my father. My father took off, and my mother was in college at the time when she got married, quit college, and then she went back to college and finished her degree and became a teacher. And we did just fine after that.
Intuited your family.
Yeah, it was the training that really saved us. It wasn't any sort of marriage counseling or relationship counseling. It was the school district in Wichita, Kansas, and my mother's degree in English. I quite agree with all that. Well, you know, it's a fascinating book, and I'm really happy that we had you on the show today. It's been a very, very interesting discussion for me. I'm of the generation that lived this, just exactly this transition. I cohabited myself. My parents did not. I have kids. I have no doubt that they will cohabit. And it's just kind of interesting to see where it all goes. And also, I really like the emphasis in the book about these comparisons with other developed nations where we also see cohabitation on the rise. The United States is something of an experiment, and we do things a little bit differently here. I mean, these are hard problems. And mm-hmm. They admit of no easy solution. I mean, we want to have children raised in a loving and reasonably, a prosperous environment. And how to get there is anybody's guess. I don't know. It's very confusing. So in any event, Liz, thanks for being on the show today. We've been talking to Liz Pleck about her book, Not Just Roommates, Cohabitation After the Sexual Revolution. Liz, I want to ask you a traditional final question on the New Books Network, and that is, what are you working on now? What's your next project?
Well, I tend to cycle around my family history topics. So if I let it sit for a while, I go back to it. And my second book was about the history of domestic violence. And so now I'm going back and looking at the new research that's being done about domestic violence in countries other than the developed world, and really reviewing the recent research, because in those countries you get a different legal system, you have different religious traditions, and different patterns that really ask us to revisit the whole question of the culture context of domestic violence.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds fascinating. I know a little bit about that as well. And they do, it's different over there. It's different in other places than we deal with it. Definitely it's different. So anyway, that sounds terrific. Again, we've been talking to Liz Pleck about her book, Not Just Roommates, Cohabitation After the Sexual Revolution. I'm Marshall Poe, the host, the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network. This particular interview will be posted on lots of channels, that's why I didn't say the host of X. And I want to thank everyone for listening to this interview, but especially I want to thank Liz Pleck for being on the show. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
All right. Bye-bye.